Chapter 12. Monlow Harbour, Nerth, Black Dawn. The first person to realize that something was terribly wrong was a subadar in the Zanzibari Hort called Lek Tanna. Tanna had woken early, before first light, with a sore head and an ardent wish to continue sleeping. A solid sort, dependable, he had pulled on his boots and his cape and climbed the bank of the earthwork from the camp to oversee the watch change. He took a restorative pinch of peck. It was an eerie time of day, with the first daylight milking into the sky. A loose wind was blowing, scudding the land between the vast earthwork and the besieged city with a spectral fog that moved like crop smoke. Tanha checked his sidearm, took another little furtive pinch, and conversed with two of the duty officers. He entered the observation redoubt, a fortified platform on the lip of the earthwork. The redoubt was open to the sky, and the wind riffled Tanha's hair. He took out a set of field glasses and aimed them at Mon Lo.
"What's that?" he asked, sniffing.
"What's what?" replied the redoubt's vox officer. The distant, wind-baffled screaming still sounded like tinnitus. There was a scent on the wind that smelled like wormwood.
"That smell," Tanha said.
"Damned infidels are burning something," said the vox officer.
"Incense?"
"No," said Tanha.
"Something else."
He looked up and listened into the windy air. A distant sound was mingling with the tinnitus. Tanha put his hand against the sandbagged edge of the redoubt's parapet. He felt a deep, ominous trembling.
"Get the Major General on the vox," he said quickly.
"What?" the vox officer replied. "At this hour?"
"Get Dev on the line now," Tanha ordered.
The vox officer scrambled to his set. Tanha raised his field glasses again and looked down into the wreathing fog bank. Subadar Lek Tanha saw what was coming towards them. He managed to speak in a desperate, fearful stammer the first two syllables of his wife's name. Then he died. A kilometre to the west, and exactly 30 seconds later, Dinast Cherikar, a senior commander of the Regnault Thorns, 2nd Division, turned sharply to his tribune loafer.
"Can we usually hear the sea from here?" he asked.
The tribune shook his head.
"No, sir." "But you heard that? A wave striking a beach?"
Loafer looked dubious.
"I heard something," he conceded.
They were walking the top of the earthwork on a standard morning patrol. Cherikar turned and looked towards the east. A great cloud, like mist or spray vapour, had enveloped the top of the earthwork a kilometre away. It was hanging in the air, like a pale hill that had not been there before.
"What is that?" Cherikar asked.
Loafer did not reply. The duckboards under their feet had begun to shake. The Dynast and his tribune instinctively raised the spikes of their armour, barbing themselves with the psychoreceptive steel quills that gave their regiment its name. Studded all over with lethal blades, they drew their weapons and turned to meet the onslaught. The beautiful, mechanised blade systems of their ancient warsuits did not save them, nor did the weapons in their hands.
"Get up!" Che roared. "Get up, now!"
"Go away, or I shall kill you," Bronzy told his bashaw and turned over in his bedroll.
Che kicked his hetman squarely in the arse, which was presenting a reasonably generous target area.
"Get up!" Che shouted.
Bronzy got to his feet, rubbing his offended backside, blinking in the half-light of the frame tent. His mind was addled, trying numbly to distinguish bits of memory that were real from pieces of dream that were not. He was reasonably sure that Gino Bashaws didn't usually wake their hets with a boot in the seat of the pants.
What? Bronzy asked.
Che stared at him. There was a token of anxiety in the Bashaw's eyes, the sort of look that no man as big and well-muscled as Che should ever have the need to display.
Get up, Het, Che repeated.
Bronzy was already heading for the tent flap, hopping as he tried to run and put on his boots simultaneously. He could already hear it, plain as day. The murmur. From a distance, war made a particular sound. The quake of the ground, the throb of engines, the rattle of weapons, the thump of detonations, the hollow of voices. It all blended together into a kind of ominous murmuring, the feral grumbling of a monster waking over the next hill. Hurtado Bronzy had heard the murmur dozens of times in his life. It had always augured days that he was lucky to live through, or hours that he could never forget. Outside, first light was on them. Commotion ran through the camp as the jokers scrambled to readiness. Bronzy looked up at the sky. The slowly turning clouds were staining pink, like blood in water or nerthine silk. He could smell wormwood on the wind's bad breath. To the east, what looked like a vast, slowly creeping dust storm had shrouded the army lines, obscuring even the dark shoulder of the earthwork. Bronzy pushed through his swarming men, yelling out orders and calling for a vox. Bashaws spread out from him like shrapnel from a grenade, conducting and relaying those orders in unequivocal tones, putting rigidity and structure into a company caught on the back foot. Still calling for a vox, Bronzy hauled himself up the ladder of one of the observation derricks. Halfway up, he looked down at Che and called his name. Che tossed his scope up to him. Bronzy caught it one-handed, uncapped it, and scanned east. Adjacent to the Joker's encampment, an Outremar infantry group was assembling from its tents and billets with the same kind of mad scramble that beset the Geno. Beyond that, yes, now, he saw it. Veiled by the dust, the sporadic flash, flash, flash of explosions looked like someone flicking a signal lamp behind a dust shawl. The blasts were ripping off as quickly and frenetically as firecrackers. He could hear heavy weapons chattering and the bass drum beat of artillery positions waking up. Drums, too, real drums, beat wild and rapid tattoos. A few seconds later, las batteries in redoubts to the southeast began spitting incandescent shooting stars north into the dust cloud, adding their squeals to the communal murmur. Bronzy saw movement in the filmy edges of the advancing dust storm and resolved it into shapes, figures.
"Holy fog," he whispered.
Once, during his childhood in Edessa, Bronzy had witnessed a blight swarm on the move. For centuries, great tracts of Osroini and the Mesop Delta had been seeded with genic cereals as part of the Emperor's program to improve food yield for the regenerating world, and surge years of insect overbreeding were triggered every few decades by overabundant harvests. The swarm had darkened the sky, turning day to night, a dense river of locusts 70 kilometers long. He had never forgotten the sound of a trillion wings, a purring noise like the murmur of war. He had never forgotten the sight. He was reminded of it, forcibly. The Nerthine were spilling out of the roiling haze in huge numbers, a blight swarm of charging infantry and racing cavalry, sweeping in over the earthwork and down across the Imperial lines like an avalanche. Ekvinurth warriors led the host, their whirling falxes glittering in the curiously dull light. A tide of Nerthadra followed them. Through the dust and broken light, their pink silks looked black, like the bodies of milling, teeming locusts. Bronzy saw swaying standards of reeds and crocodilia, banners of lizard skin trailing like friable green metal, nodding totem staves depicting scale, tooth, and biforked tongue. There was no regimentation, no order of battle. Nerthine cavalry charged along in the midst of the massed foot troops. He saw individual lancers whooping and howling, mounted on galloping monitors the size of grocs. Giant caimans, dull as coal, their scutes and teeth plated in gold, trudged forwards, bearing howdahs full of equinearth archers on their broad backs. Primitive gunpowder rockets whooped out of the hosts like fireworks exploding amongst the army encampments. Fletched darts fell like rain. The murmur was no longer a murmur. It had become a roar. Bronzy leapt off the derrick ladder and landed amongst his men. Whichever army component had been camped east of the Outremar Infantry Group's billet had already been swallowed up by the Nerthine storm, and Bronzy had seen enough to know that the Outremars were falling in droves, falling like genic crops beneath a hungry blight swarm as the storm swept on across their position. Bronzy reckoned that he had less than 5 minutes before the Nerthine assault reached him.
"A cat formation!" he bellowed to his Bashaws. "Six lines! Cannons to the front! Mortars to the ridge there! Relay this! Relay it!"
The Jokers moved like an intricate mechanism, forming structures across the land south of the earthwork. Two lines of alternating pike and carbine rifle solidified along the northern edge, behind the livestock corrals and the latrines. Cannon crews grimaced as they struggled to heave their heavy weapons, ammo crates and tripods, to new positions. Men ran past him, lugging the iron tubes of mortars across their shoulders.
"Forwards! Forwards!"
Bronzy yelled at the rifle carders. He was waving his sabre above his head. Che appeared and passed Bronzy a vox horn.
"Jokers! Jokers! Jokers!" Bronzy yelled. "Mass incursion at CR 88 and eastwards. Reporting mass assault at this time. We are preparing to resist. Support requested."
"Joker Lord, we are aware," the vox replied. "Stand ready. March in fortune. We are redeploying strengths to your position."
"Standing by,"
Bronzy snapped. He tossed the vox horn back to Che.
"Get the fucking banner aloft!"
Bronzy looked back at the doom rushing to engulf them. He realized it wasn't the crowing enemy forces that he really feared, despite their numbers, but the slow dust cloud that came with them and disgorged them, towering 10 times higher than the earthwork ramp. It was like a mountain about to fall on him. The chamber of the Terracotta Palace, secured for central operations, had turned into an undignified scrum of shouting, gesticulating personnel. A crowd of Uxors and senior officers had invaded the place, demanding information as they jostled to get a look at the main strategy display, a hololithic chart table that dominated the centre of the room. Some of them were half-dressed, their eyes puffy with sleep. Some were still buttoning tunics or fastening robes. Around the chamber walls, the vox adepts of tactical and provisional called out reports from their cogitator stations in voices that overlapped the queries of the crowd.
"Incursion report CR-88 and eastwards.
Massive numbers. Support stations engaging.
We have no response from CR-89 and CR-90.
Get a station report from the 4th Hussars. Reporting losses at CR-91.
And say that again. Again! Losing your feed, CR-90.
CR-93 reports contact.
Silence!
Major General Dev entered through the west door.
"Take your places and behave according to your ranks," he snarled.
Uxors and officers alike, cowed by his tone and his authority, fell silent and straightened respectfully. Dev's adjutant took the Major General's helm and sword from him, and Dev stepped forwards to the table, peering at it.
"They took us by surprise?" he asked.
"Completely, sir," said the senior adept.
"Assessment?"
the Major General asked, leaning on the edge of the chart table and peering down. The glow from its surface underlit his face.
"We're still waiting for the orbital appraisal," the senior adept replied. "There is an atmospheric peculiarity that..."
"I'm not waiting for orbitals," said Dev sharply. "Someone give me a decent assessment."
"A major incursion has breached the earthwork in an 11-kilometre line between CR-88 and CR-96, Wadi Gez, so-called the Little Sink," said Sri Vet, the Uxor Primus,
tracing her finger across the hololithic chart.
"I cannot appreciate precise numbers, but it feels like tens of thousands."
"I would concur with the Primus," said Uxor Banea. "Their forces struck 8 minutes ago and overwhelmed the earthwork by sheer dint of numbers."
"And took us by surprise?" asked Dev. "A force that size? They just sneaked up a division of warriors and dropped them on us? Doesn't that seem unlikely?"
"They are cloaked by a vapor cloud," said Uxor Sanzi. "That must surely be more than the dust produced by their movements. The cloud struck the earthwork first, with a kinetic force akin to a tsunami."
"More air magic," suggested a Torrent officer.
"Do not," said Dev, raising a finger to him. "Do not let the Lord Commander hear you utter those words."
The Torrent officer made a quick namaste and backed away. Dev glanced towards the Uxors around the table.
"Thank you for your frank appraisal, Uxors. How accurate should I consider them to be?"
"Our septs are sharp," said Uxor Sanzi.
"We feel this," added Uxor Banea. "I have a company at CR-90, the Jacks. I sept that they are already dead."
Dev nodded.
"I'm sorry for your loss, Uxor Banea."
Banea nodded back, and, tearful, accepted Sri Vet's consoling embrace.
"Everyone will be mourning losses before the day is out, sir," said Sri Vet.
"We are mobilizing the armored cavalry at CR-713, Dynast Keel of the Thorns announced, "and the Outremar reserves at Tel Shirak."
"Sri Vet has directed 4 Geno companies to move along the line to support the forces at CR-88, said Honan Mu. "More are needed, in my opinion."
"Provided they bring their armor support," put in a Hort officer. "Armor's what we need."
"Armor will not suffice," Mu responded. "A muscular infantry riposte will be quicker to deliver. These are low-tech warriors with blades and black powder bombs and..."
"Stop wasting time with debate," Keel growled, rounding on the tiny Uxor. "This is a shambles. There is no unification of command."
Honan Mu looked Keel straight in the eyes, or at least what she could see of them beneath the bulging thorns of his visor.
"I believe, Dynast," she said levelly, "that Major General Dev is in charge."
"That was my understanding too, Keel, so stand down and bite your tongue," said Dev with a brush of his hand. "Senior, where are the nearest Titans?"
"Princeps Jeveth has already ordered the 3 Titans closest to the incursion forward to engage," the senior adept replied.
"Bless that old goat for not waiting for an order," Dev nodded. "We need to bring the weight of the Hort and Torrent forces in to dam this flood."
He began to track deployment lines across the glowing chart, conferring with the adepts and officers. Sri Vet watched, approving of his decisions, gently correcting any detail she septed as unwise. Mu wondered if it was complacency that had cost them. Besieging forces often suffered from that flaw. The expedition had bested an entire world and driven the last of its resistance back into one city to die. No one had expected the Nerthine to go back on the offensive. No, it wasn't complacency, she decided. She reminded herself that the Nerthine did not think the way Imperial humans did. Their actions were determined by values quite alien to Mu and her kind. Driven to the brink of defeat, the Nerthine had not resigned themselves to an inevitable fate. They had fought back, the way any cornered beast would. "We have underestimated the creatures of this world too many times in this campaign already," Mu thought. "Please let us not be about to do that again." The stink of wormwood was oppressively strong, and the roar of the approaching host had become so great that Bronzy could no longer hear the voices of the men around him raised in prayer. He glanced left and right, surveying his lines. The Jokers had done him every credit. Despite the extremity of the moment and the haste with which they had been obliged to assemble, the company had formed up perfectly. They were ready, pikes and carbines held at their shoulders. Bronzy was prepared to bet that the Jokers were going to be the first army unit to meet the enemy assault that morning with any kind of coordination or discipline. How the Jokers gave account of themselves in the next 30 minutes would therefore be critical. There was no possibility of the Geno Company men defeating the assault, but if they delayed it or slowed it down, it would most likely decide how the rest of that damnable day would go. A full company of Outremar regulars, flying the Samarkand banner, had rushed up into position on the Joker's right flank, taking up a line across the Billet Road and a broad valley to the south that faced the desert. A second Outremar unit, smaller but armed with weapon servitors, was moving up behind them. And the Vox said that a 6th Torrent armour unit, with infantry support, was a minute or two behind the Jokers. The Jokers' left flank was the earthwork wall. Skillful placing by Bronzy and his trusted Bashaws had spread the Jokers along the higher banks and mounds of the uneven terrain in the Billet grounds. They were getting decent tactical instruction over the Vox, and the Sept was with them. Bronzy could see how his men were tightening and adjusting their structures slightly as Moo's wisdom touched them. Bronzy nodded to himself. His company was as ready as it would ever be. He raised his sabre and held it aloft. There was a sharp crackle of gunlocks releasing. The tidal wave of enemy warriors was less than a quarter of a kilometre away, the dust storm rolling with it. Dozens of Outremar soldiers fled before it, chased out of their overrun position. They ran frantically towards the Geno line, past rows of abandoned tents and empty dugouts. The poor fools were doomed, Bronzy realized. They were in the line of fire, and he could not afford to stay his men for long enough to allow the Outremars to reach safety. War forced choices on a man, unpleasant choices. At Tel Yutan, the Alpha Legion had demonstrated how clinically such choices should be made. Compassion was a liberal folly that spared a life so that 100 others might die as a consequence. Bronzy looked up at the company banner hanging limp and heavy in the dry air. He studied the figure on the banner, the cosmic joker, the trickster god Trisomagister, capering in his motley, a belled wand in one hand, a spillglass in the other. The Joker god knew all too well how wanton and feckless fortune could be, and how quickly time ran out for those who dallied with her affections. Bronzy believed he knew Dame Fortune just as well. You paid for her time and took her service and knew that she would be with another man the moment the fancy took her. The sky overhead had darkened so much that it had turned the colour of arterial blood.
"Geno!"
he yelled. Full-throated, the men echoed the word. The time was on them. Bronzy rotated his sabre in the air, making quick, cutting sweeps. The first signal. On the low ridge to his right, the company mortar teams began to drop shells into their angled tubes and step back, heads turned aside. A plosive, hollow plunk-plunk racket began. Mortar bombs whizzed up and over onto the enemy formation, expertly ranged. Bronzy observed the thumps and flashes as they struck with a nod of satisfaction. Each blast cast up white smoke and flailing bodies. He sawed his raised sabre back and forth. The second signal. The tripod-mounted cannons and crew-served weapons began to chatter and pulse tracer and blinding las at the oncoming foe. Sections of the leading ranks were demolished. Smoke and bloody steam furled back across the Nerthine press, and chunks of shredded meat rained down on them. Bronzy saw Ekvenerth Elite judder and disintegrate as the heavy fire ripped through them. He saw a galloping monitor tumble over, disemboweled, crushing its rider under its rolling back. Bronzy chopped his sabre straight down. The third signal. The rifle lines opened fire. The lingering peal of muzzle cracks sounded like snapping twigs. Firing row by row, coordinated by the yelling Bashaws and Moo's Sept, the ranks of riflemen aimed, fired, re-aimed, fired. The effect was devastating. 500 Anatolian las carbines, hefty pulse repeaters developed from the ubiquitous Urak 1020 combat gun that had been the workhorse of every strife-age warlord's army, trained and fired by professional soldiers drilled to perfection, blazed at the Nerthine. The Jokers were especially famed for the quality of their marksmanship, a fact that Bronzy took a great deal of personal pride in. Every Joker rifleman was a crack shot by army standards. There wasn't a damn one amongst them who couldn't hit a moving game bird at 900 metres. Bronzy regularly fielded requests from other regiments asking for the loan of a rifleman or two to conduct training programmes. He bitterly regretted that Gianno Fabian and Zarico Munza, his two best marksmen, were not at his side that morning. He'd loaned them as tutors to a Gedrosian regiment on Salkizor 15 months earlier. The last he'd heard, they were en route back to him by pack ship, training tour over. Gianno and Rico were missing all of the fun, the lucky bastards. The fusillades expertly slaughtered the first 8 ranks of the Nerthine host, bringing down infantry and reptile riders alike. Though a handful of the fleeing Outremars had been clipped too, Bronzy was gratified to see that his men's vaunted skill had spared most. Frantic Outremar survivors were dashing into the Geno lines, weeping and screaming for sanctuary. Che looked at his head.
"Keep them firing," Bronzy mouthed over the din. "Sustain order until there is no distance left."
Che nodded. Bronzy lifted his sabre and held it out straight in front of him at head height. The fourth signal. The pikemen, laced in between the rows of rifles, took a step forwards with their left feet and declined their weapons into a murderous fence. Strengthened by sheaths of gravimetric force, the telescopic pikes extended until each one was 10 meters long. The pikemen kept the arches of their right feet braced over the grav counterweights in the spikes at the bases of their hafts. The last spines on the tips of the pike blades began to sizzle with rising power.
"Run on to that, you bastards," Bronzy thought. "Then you'll discover how badly a Geno company can maul you."
As if obeying his will, the Nerthine host did exactly that. The front edge of the vast blight swarm spilled across the last few metres of open ground, losing men to the sustained rifle volleys at every step. 10 meters, 5, 2, and still they came, despite their losses. For every Nerthine casualty, there were 2 more men behind to take his place and die in turn, and be replaced by 4. The Nerthine reached the pike fence. The first of them were split apart, sectioned and chopped. The next waves became impaled, bodies skewering onto pike blades like living souvlaki. The Geno pikemen leaned into the weight and multiple impacts, some grunting as their elongated poles hoisted whole bodies off the ground, writhing like speared fish, others struggling and collapsing as the crude mass of corpses pulled their pikes down. Gravitic counterweights shorted out under the demands put on them, and hafts splintered as the gravimetric sheaths supporting their outlandish lengths evaporated. Pikemen started to use broken sections of their weapons to jab and flay at the pressing tide.
"Now we're in it," Bronzy thought.
The concussion of the Nerthine charge meeting the Geno line sent a ripple of shock back through Bronzy's ordered files. For a moment, the Jokers held like a dam before floodwaters, but the pressure built rapidly. The Nerthine piled in, hundreds upon hundreds of them, packing tighter and tighter against the Geno barrier. In the gaps where the pike fence had broken, Nerthine warriors lunged and shoved and stabbed. Jokers fell down, cut open by whirring falxes, or toppled against the rows behind them. Carbines fired, point-blank and scattershot. Pressed back by the layer of the dead and dying in the buffer of the front ranks, the Jokers tried to maintain structure. The dead of both sides formed a ghastly ridge, which the Nerthine urgently scrambled over.
Blades! Blades! Bronzy yelled.
Bashaw Foe, one of his senior men, turned to relay the order. An iron dart punctured his head and he dropped on his face. Nerthine arrows were suddenly coming down like torrential rain. Every man in Bronzy's field of vision was struck by a dart. Bronzy felt one slice his right thigh and another embed itself in his left boot. He roared and threw himself forwards, sabre in one hand, Parthian revolver in the other. Sense departed. Instinct took over. He fired his pistol and saw an Ekvanerth's head spray apart. He stroked with his sword and took the top off a skull. Something hit him in the gut. Winded, he wheeled and eviscerated an Earthine with his blade. He shouldered another aside with his bulk and shot the devil in the head to make it count. Turning, he stabbed another through the chest and had to twist hard to pull his sword free. 20 seconds in, and his gun was out. He threw it at an Earthine and snorted as it bounced off the man's skull. He drew his other sidearm, a shot-loaded backup piece with a pepperpot snout of 6 barrels. The Nerthine cavalry came crashing through the dense forest of fighting bodies with an indiscriminate momentum that trampled both Nerthine and Imperial underfoot. The reptile riders bucked and lurched above the heads of the infantry like horsemen driving their steeds across a swollen river. Pikes caught some, hooking them out of their saddles, and the riderless beasts ploughed on, snapping and thrashing. More iron darts whizzed down out of the haze, dropping men by the dozen. The churned soil bristled with embedded arrows as if it was sprouting some strange new crop. The first of the monstrous caimans lumbered into view out of the swirling vapour. Bronzy had never seen animals so enormous. Dull-eyed heads the size of ground speeders, bodies the bulk of Imperial tanks. Their tails seemed to go on forever, from the ornate howdahs and fighting platforms on their massive backs. Nerthine archers in blue silks and silver mail fired salvo after salvo of iron darts from small, double-curved bows. The caimans were inexorable. Their black scales shrugged off small arms fire and snapped pike hafts, and they simply ran over anything that got in their way. Bronzy sheathed his sabre and took aim with his pepperpot. The clothes on his back felt heavy, and he knew it was due to the weight of the blood soaking into them. He lined up on the howdah of the nearest crocodilian and discharged all 6 barrels at once. Bronzy made up his own cartridges, tight packing them with twists of monofilament wire, adamantium shot and pebbles of zignite putty. 6 of them were enough to explode and shred the howdah and everything in it. Flying shot and wire injured the animal, too. It rocked and shifted its slow bulk in a slovenly pain response. Bronzy broke open his pepperpot, the smoking cases ejecting automatically, and rammed in 6 more with shaking fingers. The caiman was turning towards him, flicking men into the air with its vast snout. Bronzy clacked the stockless weapon shut and re-aimed, the ball of his right thumb wedged into his cheek. He fired again, and the tiny lethal debris of his rounds blew out the creature's throat and right shoulder in a shower of meat and blood. It crashed over, its snout gouging into the ground like a ploughshare, and its hindquarters kicked out in spasm. The tail whipped around, and 3 dozen bodies caught in its stroke flew into the air. He was about to reload, but there was no opportunity. 2 Ekvanerth came at him with their falxes. He managed to block the first swipe with his spent weapon and then let go of it to wrestle with the Nerthine. The man was screaming at him, but Bronzy had hold of his falx and jerked him close to dish out a headbutt that crushed the man's nose. The Nerthine became more pliant, and Bronzy used his grip on the falx to heave the warrior around as a shield. The other Ekvanerth had committed a swing of his falx at Bronzy, and the blade cut through his kin's back instead. The falx belonged to Bronzy suddenly. He pulled it out of the dead fingers, rotated it, and thrust it at the second Ekvanerth.
The long blade plunged in through the man's left cheek, and the tip came out of the back of his head. Bronzy jerked the unfamiliar weapon free and slashed wildly at a third Ekvanerth who was closing to his left. The blow missed, but the Ekvanerth toppled over dead anyway. Che grabbed Bronzy by the shoulder. His pistol shot had slain the enemy warrior.
"Back, Het!" Che yelled. "We have to get back!"
Bronzy knew Che was right. It was turmoil. All semblance of row and order had vanished, and the Jokers were being broken up into melee units as the Nerthine poured in. The mortar positions had been abandoned and overrun, and over to the right flank, the Outremars seemed to have collapsed entirely. The rolling wall of dust that came in with the Nerthine like a shroud was washing softly in across the Joker's stand. They had done all they could. It felt to Hurtado Bronzy that they had been fighting for 30 or 40 minutes, but, in fact, it had been little more than 10. The Sept was urging the Geno fighting men to fall back and reposition.
"Do it!" Bronzy yelled to his Bashaw. "Disengage and fall back!"
He was nursing a fancy that his men could pull away and regroup as skirmishers to harry the Nerthine flanks. But the dust was enveloping them, and there were Nerthine warriors everywhere. He realized that they would be lucky to get away alive. There was no sign at all of Lord Namet Jira's infamous rage. He patiently studied the minute-by-minute reports Tactical was providing in a composed, reflective manner. It was a curious trait, one that had undoubtedly contributed positively to Namet Jira's ascent to the highest military rank. In the grip of a genuine crisis, a glacial calm surrounded him. Lord Namet Jira had no time or energy to waste on tirades or recriminations. Those would come later, after the fact. In the heat of open war, a cold analytical focus was required.
"Our first line of resistance, which included the Joker's Geno Company, has been smothered," Major General Dev told him. "Outremar 234, Outremar 3667, and the Halt 18th have all been lost or put to rout."
Namet Jira nodded. Major General Dev and the senior officers waited for him to speak. From all sides came the low murmur of the adepts and the hum of cogitators.
"The Titans?" Namet Jira asked.
6 minutes from contact," Lord Wilde replied. "They should turn this around."
Namet Jira turned and strode out of the chamber. His retinue followed him. Chain paused and nodded to Dev, indicating that he should follow. Bounding with the vitality of a much younger man, Namet Jira took the stairs up to the observation deck two at a time, holding up the skirts of his Rakamatiz robes. His Lucifers jogged double time to keep up. They came out into the open air, into the curdled dawn. A large, low-walled terrace in the upper part of the palace precinct had been turned over to distance observation. Heavy scopes and detection grids had been erected along the parapet, and tall clusters of vox-masts stood like pollarded trees in the centre of the terrace area. The observation crews made respectful namastes as the Lord Commander appeared.
"Carry on," he told them,
with a solemn nod that seemed almost respectful. He walked across to the east-facing section of the parapet, and two adepts bowed and stood aside from a high-gain optical scope mounted on a tripod servitor.
"I wanted to see for myself," Namet Jira said quietly as Dev joined him.
"Yes, Lord."
Namet Jira peered into the scope's viewer and carefully adjusted the resonance as he turned it slowly from left to right. The crest of the earthwork rampart filled the skyline to the northeast. To the south, in the broad road gully that Imperial pioneers had constructed beyond the palace walls, a steady line of transports and tanks were churning east along the track, heading into the incoming storm. A flock of jackals whined overhead in tight formation and turned southeast to begin strafing passes. Despite the scope's powerful resolution, Namet Jira couldn't see the enemy.
but he could see the vast veil of rolling vapour that mantled them and filled the sky.
"Extraordinary," said Namatjira, straightening up.
He looked at Dev. His eyes were bright, almost excited.
"When a man finds war commonplace, it is time for him to retire from service," said Namatjira. "This reminds me why I am content to serve the Emperor for a while longer."
"Sir," asked Dev, "why is that?"
"Because it's a challenge, Dev, a revelation. The enemy has done the unexpected, and that tests us. In all of the predictive scenarios, did we ever consider that the enemy might launch a full-scale counteroffensive?"
"No, sir. Petty raids and line assaults, perhaps harrying attacks along our picket, but nothing like this. We didn't realize they had the manpower left."
"They have taught us a lesson about expectation," said Namatjira. "We have them besieged, we have them outnumbered, and we hold a clear advantage in technology. Yet they have invaded us."
"An act of desperation," suggested Dev. "We are about to take their world from them. This is a last stand, perhaps, a last effort to drive us out."
"And a brave one," Namatjira replied. "Yet it plays to our advantage."
Dev hesitated.
"Our advantage, sir?" "They have broken the siege. They have come out into the open and demanded a pitched battle. We will give them that. We will annihilate them. Nerth will be an imperial dominion by nightfall. After months of grinding nuisance war, they have handed us a swift and comprehensive final victory."
Dev nodded. Namatjira glanced up at the slow-turning sky.
"It's almost as if that is their intention," he mused. "For all the losses we may take, initially, to their brute assault, they must know our superior firepower will ultimately slaughter them. It is almost as if they are committing suicide as a race. It is almost as if they want to die in one last firestorm rather than linger on to ignominious defeat."
Namatjira turned back towards the stairs.
"Commit the Hort and the Torrent in full order to follow the Titans in and crush the enemy. No quarter, Major General."
He paused.
"By the way, where are the Alpha Legion?"
I don't know, sir," said Dev.
"Signal them, Major General," said Namatjira.
For a second, a tiny flash of his carefully suppressed rage showed itself.
"Inquire as to their status and ask respectfully if they intend to join us."
There was a distinct possibility that Hurt was already dead. Sonica stood on the brow of a dune hill 8 kilometres west of the battle and felt the presentiment sink in. He felt it in his marrow. Hurt was dead. Tactical had informed him that the Jokers had been caught right in the path of the enemy onslaught. He had twice requested permission to draw the clowns in along the southern service track to support the front line, but had been denied both times. The clowns were to hold their position. "At this time we do not know if the enemy will attempt to penetrate our line in other locations." Sonica knew that made sense. The army had to maintain a defence formation right along the earthwork wall, or be guilty of the most basic military sin. Besides, at the rate the dust cloud was creeping in, the clowns would be in it too, in no more than an hour. Yet he dearly wished he could go to his friend's aid. He'd had less than 8 hours to get to know his new command. The transport had delivered Sonica and his Bashaws to the clown billet long after dark the night before. The clowns had already begun their fireside revels and had welcomed their temporary commander with vocal enthusiasm. It had turned into a late night under the stars, fueled by the clown's bottomless supply of snaps. Sonica had spent 2 hours talking with Strabo. Fugging Strabo, who turned out to be a far more competent and likeable man than Dimi Shiban had suggested. Strabo had done his best to keep the company functioning and viable in the absence of a senior genic het. By the end of their chat, Sonica had felt a grudging admiration for the Bashaw, who had evidently been holding the clowns together with a glue composed of charisma and coercion. They spoke of Shiban, and Sonica related some of the things that had passed between him and Dimmy at Tel Kat. He chose not to tell Strabo the truth of Shiban's demise. How could a man explain that a fine officer like Dimitar Shiban had been executed by the Alpha Legion, and not have it sound like treason? Sonica stared out across the dawn landscape. Where the sun should have risen, the ominous pall of vapour hung across the skyline. The sky had congealed into a slick of brown and amber clouds, all wandering slowly against the wind and common sense. The vapour was brighter than the sky, a creamy mass like a deep desert dune caught in noon sunlight. Sonica could smell something on the wind, a resiny smell, like myrrh or wormwood. He had been thinking about Shiban a lot in the last few days. Should he have noticed some change in him, some telltale sign that Shiban was not himself? How did one detect the trace of chaos? The Alpha Legion, if they were to be believed, had some infallible method. If they were to be believed, Sonica tutted to himself. After all this, and I'm still not inclined to trust them. Drinking with Strabo the night before, Sonica had remembered an idle conversation he'd had with Shiban at Visages. It had meant nothing at the time, but in hindsight, Sonica wondered if it was some kind of sign or symptom.
"I have been dreaming lately," Dimmy had said. "In my dreams I hear a verse."
"A verse, huh?" Sonica had replied.
"I'll tell you how it goes, shall I?"
"You remember it, then?"
"Don't you remember your dreams? Word for word?" Shiban had asked.
"Never," Sonica had said.
Shiban had shrugged. "Fancy that."
"This verse," Sonica had prompted.
"That? Oh, that goes, from the hag and hungry goblin that into rags would rend ye, and the spirit that stands by the naked man in the Book of Moons defend ye."
"I know that," Sonica had said.
"You do," Shiban had replied. "Really?"
"My mother used to sing it to me when I was a boy. She called it the Bedlam Song. There were other verses that I now forget."
"Really? What does it mean?"
Sonica had shrugged.
"I have no idea."
He still had no idea, except for the awful feeling that it had been the shards of Nerthine bone lodged in Dimmy Shiban's throat shaping the words, and not Dimmy Shiban at all. Those shards of bone had been polluting his friend, corrupting him. The Alpha Legionnaires had seen it instantly and turned their weapons on him. Chaos had laced its poison claws into Dimmy Shiban's soul. If that was true, why did Sonica know the verse? Why had his mother known it to sing to him?
"Sir?"
Sonica snapped out of his thoughts and looked to his left. Lon was approaching, carbine swinging from its long strap.
"Any news?" Sonica asked.
Lon shook his head.
"Command repeats its instruction to hold here. Two units of Outremars are moving in from the east to cement this as a rearguard defence position."
Sonica nodded.
"Thank you. Let's make ready to slot them in."
"Oh, and Strabo wants you, sir," Lon added.
Sonica looked back along the ridge of the dune. The clowns were assembled in file order, facing the gauzy wound in the dust cloud where the sun should have been climbing. Their shouldered pikes glinted in the toxic light, and the company banners hung like moribund kite sails. Strabo was picking his way up the cinnamon dust of the dune towards them, followed by two riflemen and a tall man wearing the uniform of a Geno het. Sonica did not recognize the Het.
"Sir," said Strabo, arriving and saluting, "this Het has just reached our position and requests a moment of your time."
"His name?"
Strabo began.
"Sean Feichel," the Het said, sticking out his hand. Sonica took it and shook it. The name meant nothing. "Could we have a word in private?" Feichel requested. Sonica nodded. He looked back at Lon. "Have the clowns present," he ordered. "Akkad formation with Lycad reserve lines. When they get here, draw the Outremar forces around to the south and have them draw in along our left flank. Then we'll meet with their officers. Relay that to all, especially..."
"Fugging Strabo?" Strabo asked.
Sonica grinned.
"Yes, especially him."
Lon and Strabo laughed and turned back down the hill to the waiting company.
"Sean Feichel?" asked Sonica, drawing the Het aside. "And what company does Sean Feichel serve?"
The Het shrugged. "You may know me better by another name, sir," he said. "Conig Henniker?" Sonica stared at him. His hand began to move towards his holstered sidearm.
"No need for that," said Henniker.
He looked Sonica in the face. "My real name is John Grammaticus, and I need to get a message to the Alpha Legion. It's my understanding that you can arrange that."
"Your understanding?"
"Don't be coy. Is it true or not?"
"Possibly," Sonica replied carefully.
"Let's hope so, and quickly. This is the Black Dawn, and we have very little time left."
Bronzy reached Attell, 2 kilometers south of the fighting line, with about half of his company. They were all exhausted and caked in dust. It had taken 30 minutes of brutal skirmishing to break through the edges of the host pouring across them. Their heads were ringing from the demented melee, and Bronzy knew he wasn't the only one who couldn't clear his mind or stop his hands from shaking. 2 Outremar units had made it to the Tell, fragments of demolished strengths, along with a score of Torrent gunners who had been forced to abandon their artillery and flee. Bronzy took charge of the lot of them, reporting numbers and position to command. He had his Bashaws check that the bewildered gunners were armed, even if it was simply with a knife or a broken wheel spoke. Through his scope, Bronzy could see a long fan of Imperial armour drawing up across the desert from the west, trailing individual wakes of dust from their churning tracks. They were Zanzibari Horde in full force, pushing up from the marshalling fields at Wadi Sun. He wondered why they seemed to be hanging back. It was Major General Dev's habit to plunge his fast armour into enemy infantry cohorts like heavy cavalry, and they were certainly gathering in significant enough numbers to make a difference, but they seemed to be dawdling a kilometre or so west of the enemy rush. The explanation appeared. Dull giants loomed out of the west through the ochre dust, trudging slowly up out of the great Arn Akhet Wadi. They rose into view out of the desert sink, burnished monsters that walked like gods. Jeveth's titans had reached the fighting line. There were 3 of them. The driving dust was such that their distant shapes were obscured from view several times, despite their scale. Bronzy could hear the occasional metal creak or squeal of their vast, lumbering chassis. They strode through the waiting formations of Hort armour at a relentless pace, dwarfing the heavy tanks and gun platforms, and line abreast advanced on the Nerthine host. The first of them began to fire. Bronzy winced and lowered his scope. The pulsing flashes of the Titan's limb mounts were dazzling bright and left a neon afterimage on his retinas.
"Great terror," he murmured.
Fat beams of luminous energy began to rake out of their cannons and were quickly supported by huge, pumping bolts of light like shooting stars and sooty blurs of hard ordnance. The Titans seemed to smoke from head to foot, but it was just dust coming off them. The sustained recoil vibration of their weapon arrays was so great that the dust and sand accumulated during their trek to the front was shaking off their vast, plated forms in powdery swathes. Bronzy could hear the shriek and wail of their las weapons and the brisk thunder of their machine cannons. The sounds rolled to him out of sync with the flashes and light bursts. He'd seen Titans at war before, and the sight never failed to fill him with awe. He was always unprepared for the astonishing rapidity of their rate of fire, the zipping, torrential pulse and spit of green, amber and white light that unloaded from their forearms and shoulders. The ground ahead of their slow advance began to ripple and distort as it sprouted sudden forests of blooming dust, thrown-up earth and writhing fireballs. A juddering, flickering carpet of destruction spread out before them, billowing dark smoke and vaporized sand back into the edges of the pale fog that the Nerthine had brought with them. Bronzy could feel the relentless, plosive concussion of the onslaught quaking his viscera. The ground was shaking. The men around him started to cheer and bellow, but Bronzy could feel their dismay. It was not a scene that a man could witness without an involuntary shiver of fear. He wondered how many of the screaming enemy had perished in the first second, how many in the second or the third. It was impossible to see, even with his scope. He could resolve nothing except the churning smoke, the serried flicker of furious impacts, the sudden chains of fireballs igniting and expanding and overlapping. For a split second he glimpsed a dark shape that had to be a giant caiman rise up out of a flurry of detonations and then crash back like the hull of a sinking ship. The smell of wormwood had gone. In its place was the reek of superheated gases, of physoline, of molten, vitrified sand, and of burning flesh. The Titans ploughed on, stepping through the seething, burning devastation they had wrought, like men walking through low mist. Their bombardment did not relent. Behind them, the Hort armour began to spur forwards, and Bronzy heard the distant slap and howl of tank guns beginning to hammer. The Titans reached the edge of the Nerthine storm cloud and waded into its pale fog. For the first time since dawn, the ominous pall began to recoil and fold back on itself, as if the three huge war machines were a fresh breeze out of the desert, slowly blowing the stain away. Sonica led Henniker, or whatever his name was, down the wadi to where the company's support vehicle sat. He felt a deep unease, as if he was embarking on some unconscionable betrayal. He also knew it was far too late to consider such niceties. He'd made a choice, and he had to live with it. "They're looking for you," he said. "Who is?" asked Henniker. "Everyone," Sonica replied. "I know. I also know who I want to be found by." "The Astartes?" Henniker nodded. "Why?" asked Sonica. "It's complicated. The simple answer is that I believe they will listen to me. Your masters in the Imperial Army would simply execute me as the Nerthine agent they believe I am." Henniker looked at Sonica with a strange smile. "Except they're not your masters, are they?" he asked. "Not anymore. I mean, you don't answer to them first, do you?" Sonica did not reply. "How did that happen?" Henniker asked. "Have you been an operative for a long time, or was it a recent thing? Did they co-opt you or coerce you?" "That's enough. I'm simply interested in how they work, how their mechanism functions." "You're not asking the right man," Sonica told him. "Just wait here." Henniker nodded and remained where he was. Sonica walked over to an open-topped staff track and told the driver to go for a walk.
"Sir?"
"I need to use the Vox," said Sonica. "Clearance only."
"Yes, sir,"
the man said, and jumped out of the cab. He wandered away in the direction of a group of drivers sitting in the shade of a transport. Sonica switched on the track's box unit and let it warm up. He kept glancing over at Henniker, but the man showed no sign of disappearing. When the Vox was up to power, Sonica reached into his pocket and took out his biometric. He looked at it for a moment. It would be an easy thing to slot it in, contact Moo, and make a report. An easy thing. Company first, Imperium second, Gino before Jean. Was it really too late for that now? He sighed, put the biometric down on the top of the set, and typed a 7-digit channel code into it instead. The Vox whispered for a moment, and then a voice answered.
Speak and identify.
Linnaean, 841, said Sonica. The Vox murmured. As Sonica watched, the encryption lights on its display lit up, one by one.
Speak.
Is this link secure? Sonica asked.
You can see that for yourself.
Is this link secure?
Yes, Peto. Be assured of it. Do you have information for us?
Sonica swallowed. I have Konig Henniker. There was a pause.
Repeat, Peto.
I have Konig Henniker, Sonica said.
In your custody? Asked the Vox.
In my company. He surrendered himself to me 10 minutes ago. He says he has a message for you. Vital, apparently. There was another pause.
What is your location, Peto?
Sonica read out his chart referent.
Bring him to us.
I can't just bring him to us. Listen to me. I am on active station. My company is in the field. Have you seen what's going on out there?
We have.
I can't just leave my post. I have a duty.
Yes, you have, the Vox said. There is no alternative. Trust us. Bring Henniker to CR-583 immediately. We will cover you.
Sonica began.
Is that understood?
Look, it's not as if I can...
Is that understood?
Yes, said Sonica quietly.
Please confirm that this is understood.
Yes, it is, said Sonica. Please confirm the chart referent. CR-583.
The link went dead.
The encryption lights faded out one by one. Sonica sat back and exhaled hard. He keyed off the set, retrieved his biometric, and got out of the track.
Well? Asked Henniker.
You look unhappy. Don't talk to me. Just shut up and follow me. They slogged back up the soft drift sand of the wadi, and Sonica made Henniker wait while he called to Lon.
What's up? Lon asked, jogging over.
I've got to go.
What? Lon laughed. Go? Go where?
I can't explain. It's classified.
Lon stared at him. Classified? What are you talking about, Het? Are you army intelligence all of a sudden?
Something like that. Sonica jerked his head in Henniker's direction. Listen, Lon, I think this guy's got information. He whispered.
I think he might even be one of the spies everyone's gossiping about.
What?
Just listen. I need to deliver him to the Gene Whips or someone.
How long are you going to be? Asked Lon.
Half an hour? I don't know. You're in charge. Tell Strabo you're in charge, my authority.
You've only been with the clowns a few hours, Lon began.
Then they're not going to miss me much, are they?
Sonica replied.
This is important. I'll be back as quickly as I can.
The Bashaw looked unhappy. Finally, he shrugged his heavy heterosis magnified shoulders.
Whatever you think best, sir, he said.
Thank you.
Does Uxor Moo know about this?
Lon asked. Sonica shook his head. I can't trust the Vox, not even encrypted.
And if she asks for you? If Command asks for you?
Tell them to stand by. Tell them I have left my station to deal with a critical matter and that I will report to her as soon as I can.
Lon nodded.
March in fortune.
Sonica said.
You too, Het.
Sonica requisitioned a light ATAV from the supply line, and they headed southwest across a patch of open desert that resembled a dried seabed. The daylight had taken on an even more unsettling cast, and the sky had turned the colour of beaten copper.
It's not getting any lighter, muttered Sonica as he drove.
You notice that, Henniker replied.
What's going on? What's a black dawn?
Something unexpected. Something vile. The Nerthine's last gift to you.
To me, personally,
Henniker laughed. To the Imperial Expedition.
Interesting choice of words, Sonica replied, fighting with the wheel as they shook over the uneven crust.
It implies you are not Imperial.
I'm not.
Sonica risked a glance at him.
What the hell are you, then?
I'm human. At least, human enough for your needs. I'm not the enemy. You have to understand that. I'm fighting for the same cause as you.
Which is?
The survival of the species. My one wish is to save the human race from the slow and tormenting death that is about to overtake it.
It would be great if you started dealing in specifics, said Sonica.
There's a war coming, said Henniker.
We're at war all the time. It's the natural state of mankind in this era.
Henniker looked out at the desert scrub flashing past.
This is a special kind of war. It will make all others seem futile and small. The Imperium is simply not prepared for it.
Sonica checked the chart display and turned them a few points west along the edge of a great sink where the wind was lifting white sand off the rim like steam.
Can I ask you a question? Henniker said.
You can try.
Is Roxana alive?
Sonica hesitated before answering.
Yes, I think so. She was when I last saw her.
The Astartes got you to deliver her to them, didn't they?
Yes, said Sonica. For her own safety.
If that's what they said, Henniker remarked,
it must be true.
She, Sonica began,
I'm sorry, I was reluctant to bring her to them, and I have regretted it since. Army intelligence was close to taking her. They had discovered the link between you and her.
Henniker nodded.
Pedo Sonica, he said.
What?
Nothing. It's funny. Not long ago, I had almost decided to be you.
What does that mean? Asked Sonica.
I'm talking about borrowing identities from the dead, but it turns out you're not dead.
CR-583 was a ruined Nerthine bastion on a sandstone crag overlooking a wide dune sea. The crag ran north in jutting steps and joined the lip of the continental shelf where it dropped away into the Mon Low coastlands. The dimpled expanse of the dune sea stretched away to the south and had turned silver-grey in the malevolent light, like a sheet of chainmail spread out and stretched as far as the eye could see. There was no heat, just a cold, restless wind. Sonica brought the ATAV up under the shadows of the crag, and they dismounted. The bastion was one of a chain of ancient Nerthine watchtowers that had once guarded the threshold of the open desert, but it had been abandoned and left to ruin centuries before the expedition arrived. It was built of large, hard stone blocks, sagging and crumbling in places. The upper levels were gone, and blank spy holes looked out over the dunes like empty eye sockets. They clambered up the slopes of weathered scree and jumbled boulders. Many of the larger fragments were blocks from the tower that time had pulled down. The place was full of chilly echoes. As their boots disturbed loose pebbles and stones, the clatters repeated around them, spectral and hollow.
This feels wrong, said Sonica, drawing his pistol.
They're just not taking any chances with me, Henniker told him.
Sonica looked up at the crude walls of the bastion above them. He didn't seem convinced. They clambered up a little further to the foot of the bastion.
"There, you see," said Henniker. "This is the right place."
He pointed. A small but distinct mark had been heat-scored into the face of a loose block just ahead. The symbol matched the one branded on Sonica's flesh.
"Another House of the Hydra," Henniker muttered.
"What?" Henniker pushed past him and climbed up a bank of sand silt to the tower's open gateway. As he passed the marked block, he touched it.
"Still warm," he called back. "They haven't been here long."
They walked under the heavy stone lintel of the gate and entered the tower. Its internal floors and staircases had gone, leaving an empty sleeve of stone open to the sky. It took a moment for their eyes to grow accustomed to the gloom. Through the window slots and open roof, they could see patches of cold, dull sky.
"Hello," said Henniker.
"Hello, John." Two Astartes stood in the darkness waiting for them. They were in full warplate, but their helmets were off. In the half-light, Sonica realized that he couldn't tell them apart. They were like twins.
"Herzog, Pech," Henniker said, nodding to them.
"How?" Sonica began.
"John Grammaticus is a marvelously perceptive being," said a deep voice behind them.
A third Astartes came out of the shadows.
"Alpharius," said Henniker.
Sonica heard the confidence slip slightly from the spy's voice.
"Can you be certain?" asked the third Astartes.
Henniker recovered his composure slightly.
"Yes, I have heard your voice before, at the pavilion. I never forget a vocal pattern, and your build is appreciably larger than that of your captains. You are the Primarch Alpharius. Lord, it has taken a great deal of time, effort, and trouble to meet you."
"From the way you have evaded us, John, it would seem that you were keen to postpone that moment," Alpharius observed.
"Things have changed," said John Grammaticus. "More than ever, I need to speak to you, and you need to listen."
"Then let us withdraw and speak," said Alpharius.
The two towering captains stepped forwards and flanked Henniker, leading him towards the tower's doorway. Henniker looked back over his shoulder at Sonica.
"Thanks," he said.
Sonica shrugged. The Astartes led Henniker out of the tower.
"Well done, Peto," said the armored giant.
Sonica holstered his gun and made a solemn namaste.
"I must return to my unit, Lord," he said. "The quicker I can resume my duties, the—"
"No, Peto. I'm sorry. You can't."
"Why not?" Sonica asked.
"Peto, there is a question you haven't asked yourself."
"And that is?" Sonica replied.
"How did Konig Henniker know that you were an operative of the Alpha Legion? How did he know how to find you?"